from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Anna Deavere Smith is a playwright and actress whose transformational one-woman shows have been celebrated for their unique blend of art and journalism. The MacArthur Fellow joins us to discuss a career stretching from TV's The West Wing and Nurse Jackie to her recently being awarded the National Humanities Medal by President Obama. That's up next on Forum, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Anna Deavere Smith is best known for her theatrical innovation using real people and real events in documentary solo shows she writes and performs. Known for such original and highly praised documentary solo shows as Fires in the Mirror, about the racial strife in Crown Heights, Twilight Los Angeles, about the 1992 riots following the Rodney King police brutality case, and Let Me Down Easy, a production all about illness in the U.S. healthcare system. She also has appeared as an actor in the film American President and as Nancy McNally on The West Wing and as the tough honcho in Showtime's Nurse Jackie. She's a Stanford University drama professor, a recipient of an Obie Award, a MacArthur Genius Award, and the Dorothy Lillian Gish Award, and most recently, a National Humanities Medal presented to her by President Barack Obama. This morning's Forum Hour, we want to welcome back Anna Deavere Smith and congratulate you, by the way, on the National Medal of Honor. Tell us what that, well, first
Thank
of all,
you.
Glad to have you back here. What was that like?
Oh, it was just great. You know, it was just great. The, you know, fabulous people who I have admired for a long time, Joan Didion, George Lucas, Tony Kushner, Bob Silver, Natalie Zeman Davis, one of the first people I ever interviewed when she was at Princeton, who I was quite intimidated by at the time. So it was wonderful. It's always special to be in the White House. I kind of think that one of the best jobs in the country is the person who stands at the door when you go to the White House for an event like that and says, "Welcome to the White House." Because with all the problems in the world, somehow the White House manages to maintain its magic.
Is that the first time you met President Obama?
No. No. In fact, President Obama, I interviewed him right after his groundbreaking speech at the Democratic Convention when Kerry was running for president, and was able to interview him for a piece I wrote in the New York Times, an op-ed that I wrote, actually, that in which he factored greatly. And then he introduced me in Chicago while he was still senator when I was doing an event that Studs Terkel was supposed to introduce me for, and our dear Studs was too ill to do it. And so backstage I hear the senator, Obama, introducing me. So I've had the opportunity to meet him a number of times.
You know, as high points go, I was reading an interview where you were saying that, and I really related to this, that your father had never said, "I'm proud of you," until you got tenure as a professor. My father was actually pleased when I got tenure, though I never heard those words from him. George Steinbrenner, at George Steinbrenner's funeral, somebody said, if he had only heard his father say, "Son, I'm proud of you," he would have given it all up, everything, you know. And it means a lot to people, especially fathers who don't exactly lavish their children with praise. But, I mean, is there a hierarchy that you have? I mean, where does that fit into, say, getting a National Medal of Honor or getting a Obie or getting a—
Oh, isn't that a great question? I suppose that the right answer, which I can't call up for you right now, is something that doesn't have to do with anything like that. You know, a moment when you see something about somebody else that you're happy you were able to see. No, I don't think there's a hierarchy, really. I think in the case of this particular medal, I'd known since May. They just didn't let us tell anybody. You know, so that was a lot of news to hold till July the 12th. But what pleases me about it is that when I started studying acting way back ages ago here in this city at the American Conservatory Theater, I just knew I wanted to use art to reach people. I was hoping that what I was going to do would have an impact in the universities and cause people to think differently. So when I got that call in May from the then head of the National Endowment for the Humanities saying that I'd gotten the award, I felt very pleased because it's not something you can compete for. And it made me feel great that there are people out there in the humanities who feel that my work has been useful. So I would say that it was a feeling of a long scope of my life, a long project, that it was recognized made me feel pretty cool. And I do wish that my mother and father were alive to see the day, because I know it would have made them very, very excited. My mother was able to see me perform while Clinton was in the audience. And, you know, these things did mean a lot to them.
Well, you talked at one point about learning words from Richard III of Queen Margaret and saying those words over and over again. I mean, at one point, you were really training to be an actor. You wanted your chops as an actor, really.
Oh, wow, yeah. I mean, well, it was very hard not to want those chops at ACT at the time when they had a company of 52 people. And, you know, I was in the first class of MFAs. It was hard not to want your chops there, because every night we would see what was happening on the stage. And we also admired those incredible actors, Peter Donat, you know, Elizabeth Huddle, all of those, Joy Carlin, all those extraordinary people. We wanted to be like them, wanted to grow up. So I quickly fell in love with the process and the desire for a discipline.
But then there was a transition to actually, well, being a performer in the way that you became identified as a performer, where you were taking all this documentary material and really coalescing it into a performance and taking these voices and doing what you've become really famous for. Where was the transition, or was it?
It was with that queen, you know. I mean, when people say, well, who influenced you in your life? I mean, I do have to say, after a point, you know, well, it was a queen, and it was Queen Margaret. And this whole idea that she could curse, you know, she felt she could bring bad things with the use of words. And at the end of Richard III, a younger dignitary asks her, well, you know, teach me how to curse. And Queen Margaret basically says, this is
we got to be careful here with FCC.
This is different cursing, right? But she simply says, this is a paraphrase, you know, if you had woes like mine, your words would cut. This is not what she said, but a paraphrase. So this really led me to looking for people with woes, to tell you the truth. If you look at my body of work, I'm really interested in catastrophe. I'm interested in woeful situations and woeful people, because I know that they have very, very dynamic words, words that can lead to action. So that, to me, too, is a political call. Many of the speakers who I've listened to, and especially in those early days, were political speakers, FDR, Martin Luther King, President Kennedy. Listening, Fidel Castro, even though I couldn't understand Spanish, just listening to the rhythm, how does a person have a real effect with their words? What does that call for? And so it's not just content. It's also a certain dynamic that has to happen. FDR was speaking in a way to cause people to waltz with him. I'm looking for my nation. For essential human freedoms. That's a waltz. President Obama tends to speak with sentences that come to an end. Now, our Shakespeare teachers would say, don't let your words go down. Somehow that works for Obama. He spoke that way in his campaign. When I think what he's doing in a very, very subtle way with that particular rhythm is trying to give us very subtle marching orders.
It's almost in many ways also the music of different voices that
right.
You are attuned to. I mean, there's kind of operatic and jazz-like qualities to these performances that you're so well known for, but getting the cadences, getting the inflections, getting the whole sense of the euphony of the language and how it sounds and so forth. And yet at the same time, New York Times once said, you get the soul of these people too.
Well, that's a pretty deep word. You know that I'm on the board of Grace Cathedral.
Yes, I know.
I mean, soul is a big word.
You are a soul catcher, according to some.
I guess I'm soulful. I guess I got some soul.
Well, growing up in black segregated Baltimore, you, yeah. I mean, have that advantage yeah. of perhaps having soul in terms of your background. But the truth of the matter is that you're onto something different now. I mean, Dulles, talk about writing a play.
Right.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, I'm very excited about this. Talk about woeful. Woes. Woo! Woe is this word. Is woe, W-O-H.
Woe is the word, yeah.
Woe is us. So my new play is about education. And
you got the family lineage.
I got the family lineage. My mother was a teacher. All of her sisters and my father's sisters were teachers. And that's what a black woman, Negro woman at the time, colored woman at the time, could do with an education, teacher or nurse for the most part. So I grew up with it. I've been teaching very fancy people for my career, somebody turned me on to just how profoundly bad it has become for poor people. And so I'm very interested in looking at the people who are shoved out, who are left behind, and that's what's going to be consuming a lot of my time in the next year or so.
Oh, good luck with that. You know, you've talked about how much work goes into the productions you do, hundreds and hundreds of hours. I mean, a lot of it just listening, really, and absorbing and assimilating. What kind of effect and impact do you hope to have? You talked about being political. You talked about, you know, wanting to make a difference and so forth. And can you measure that? Can you get a metric on it?
Isn't no. that terrible? I would never say that I could do that. What I think can happen, not just with me, but there's so many young artists out there all around the world, and certainly San Francisco is a hotbed of this type of artist, and this is really something that I've seen develop in the last 15 years and seemingly exploded, particularly after September 11th. There's a whole lot of people who want their work to be significant in a given moment and to change something about the way we live and the way we think. So although we can't necessarily measure it, I do know that in my artistic lifetime, pretty much that stark line between what is art and what is not art because you're trying to bring a message has softened. And people aren't as afraid that, you know, it's propaganda necessarily. Or in my case, I try to look at a big picture. I look at all the points of view. That sort of saves me, I think, I hope, from being a propagandist. And I also use every single skill that I have developed over years to try to deliver something that is artistically sound at the same time that I'm hoping it's not so much bringing a message, but stepping in where politics really can't. And that is to try to hit where people think and feel, not just thinking, but feeling, and not just feeling, but thinking, so that, you know, maybe they contribute differently, those who are philanthropic, and any of us can be philanthropic, whether it's 25 cents or $25 million, those who are teaching in schools, those who are dealing with their children a little bit differently. I mean, I think we need several works of art, for example, about what just happened with Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, I imagine, given your track record, you were probably drawn to that story, weren't you?
I was certainly drawn to the story, but I do what I'd rather have resound today on your show is I hope that lots of artists were drawn to it. Artists on each side of the story. And that they will come forward with works which will cause us to keep thinking about it when the media is no longer interested and when politics has moved on to something else. I mean, one of the things that the president talked about was that he talks about his convening power, and that he said he and Michelle often are thinking about, you know, the real tragedy that so many African-American males or males of color are not participating productively in our society. What will we do about that? Well, I think there's lots of ways that art can come in to make suggestions. We heard a whole lot about African-American males. What will I tell my son? I didn't hear enough from white people saying, what will I tell my son? What will I tell my daughter about this? So I think that in many ways, as Americans, we've lost our passion for being in it together. And I think this is something that art can really help us do.
This may be a good segment to hear something you did. In April 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote his famous letter from a Birmingham jail, and it was a response to an open letter to Southern white clergymen who were calling for an end to civil rights demonstrations. And Dr. King replied by explaining what it means to be a black person living in America at the time, and Anna Deavere Smith performed portions of that letter at the Aspen Ideas Festival to celebrate the letter's 50th anniversary. And just a note to our listeners, we're going to let you hear this. Some of the language may be offensive, but was taken directly from the letter and was the language used by Dr. King himself. Let's hear a clip.
When you take a cross-country drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in the uncomfortable corners of your automobile because no motel will accept you. When you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored. When your first name becomes nigger, your middle name becomes boy, however old you are, and your last name becomes John. And your wife and mother are never given the respected title of Mrs. When you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are a Negro living constantly in tiptoe stance, never quite knowing what to expect next, and are plagued with inner fears and outer resentments. When you are forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobody-ness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait.
That was Anna Deavere Smith performing a portion of Letter from a Birmingham Jail at the Aspen Ideas Festival earlier this year. Stanislavski technique notwithstanding, do you become Dr. King when you do?
No.
Not at all?
No, and that was never recorded. Dr. King never recorded it, so I didn't, you know, I wasn't trying to mimic him, obviously. I don't have any idea how he would have said it. You know, that was an extraordinary experience to have that opportunity to speak that material. What you didn't hear in the background was was the Arvo Part Spiegel and Spiegel, which is so exquisite. Bobby McDuffie accompanying me on violin. And so to work with Mr. McDuffie to have that text was extraordinary. And, you know, we think one of the reasons I'm so interested in going back and looking at language, even if it's something that somebody said to me yesterday, and to look at it carefully, is that, you know, we have an idea about Dr. King. So many of those specifics are so gorgeously rendered. The notion of a nobodiness, right? And he goes on to continue to be that eloquent for, I don't know, it'd probably be 30 minutes long. I was lucky that the great theologian, or rather scholar of religion, she makes a difference, Elaine Pagels, actually helped me edit it down. I just can't even tell you what it meant to investigate those extraordinary words. And the sad thing is that so much of it is still true. This idea of living in nobodiness, when I think about the streets where people are poor and suffering in this country, that nobodiness is still the case. The
gap. This is a great part of what you see as almost a kind of mission, I would imagine, just extrapolating from things I've read that you've said and what I know about you. You want to teach people to be empathic, and be empathic particularly to those who feel nobodiness.
Yeah, but to cause others to think about what that means.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah.
Right. I mean, so, you know, soon after that, when, beautiful when descant, King talks about Martin Buber and what it means to go from an I-thou relationship to I-it, to turn people to it. And that's what we are doing. And when we rely only on data, it's not enough because people are just numbers on a page. So again, if artists will come forward and bring that sense of somebodiness, put a face on it about the people who are suffering and lost and shoved out of our society. And in terms of education, lots of people, just most recently I read Richard Haas's book on national security. The chapter on education calls it a security problem.
So, yeah, we featured that book, actually.
Great. I'm interested in it as a moral crisis, but it's a security crisis.
Well, by contrast, you've done, you know, Nurse Jackie, and you've done West Wing. Actors constantly complaining about how talky Aaron Sorkin is for the characters that he writes Now We've Got Newsroom and so forth. I want listeners to hear Anna Deavere Smith playing National Security Advisor Nancy McNally in The West Wing from 2000 to 2006. Here she's explaining to a character played by Rob Lowe why the man he's been defending is really a spy.
Sam, Daniel Galt was a spy.
Oh, my God.
He was a Soviet spy.
Based on what?
Diplomatic cables intercepted by U.S. Army signal intelligence in the 1940s.
If that was the case, why couldn't the U.S. attorney make espionage in the 1950s?
Because the cables weren't decrypted until the 1970s.
You're telling me that we cracked some obscure Russian code and suddenly we learned Galt was a spy?
Yes.
That's crap. If the FBI had proof on Galt, they would have told the world about it.
No, they wouldn't have, Sam.
Nancy?
No, they wouldn't have. Neither would the NSA, neither would Central Intelligence. You don't show someone you've broken their ciphers unless you have to. Galt was long dead. But before he was an agent called Blackwater. He was a delegate at Yalta, and he returned to the U.S. by way of Rostov, where he was awarded the Order of Lenin.
Yeah, well, I'll believe that when they show me the file. It's not an FBI file.
It's an NSA file.
Nancy, I'm classified, but I don't have code word clearance.
I know.
I'm saying I'm not allowed to see that. And you could get into trouble for showing it to me.
I could go to jail for showing it to you.
That was Anna Deavere Smith in The West Wing. And maybe Edward Snowden may go to jail for showing some of those files. That brings us to another story. I want to find out, though, from you, I mean, playing a role like that, as opposed to doing something which has a lot more, I suppose, gravitas and seriousness behind it, like reading, reciting a letter from a Birmingham jail. It almost seems a whole continuum in many ways.
But I think that's the case of all actors, that there's the whole continuum. You know, if you have a career that lasts any time, that's what happens. That's what we want to do, is keep, you know, expanding and changing and having different opportunities. One quick story: when I was doing The West Wing, there was a beauty salon that I went to in Los Angeles, and there was a guy who never really said much to me, Japanese from Japan, not Japanese American. And then one day he looked over, he spotted me, and his eyes widened. He said, "Oh my God, you won that show! I can't understand everybody talks so fast. I don't know what they say. I just know every time you come, everybody's scared." So it's sort of, you know, this arrival of Nancy McNally. But, you know, for me, it's a real privilege on a show like that to get to work with John Spencer and Martin Sheen, Aaron Sorkin, and now to be in a community of folks with Nurse Jackie, with Edie Falco, and the incredible cast and the writing. So I love the opportunity to be in these larger, more complex sort of cultures of making stuff. It's really great. I'm really fortunate that I get to do it.
We're talking with Anna Deavere Smith, and this is an opportunity for those of you who, well, are interested in her artistry or are interested in talking to her to indeed avail yourself of the opportunity. There are a number of ways you can join us, and I'd like to invite you to do that now with any questions or comments you might have. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join the program, and you can do that now at 866-733-6786. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page, and certainly we welcome your involvement in the program. Anna Deavere Smith is a playwright and actress whose transformational one-woman shows have been celebrated for their unique blend of art and journalism, and MacArthur Fellow joining us this hour to discuss her career, which stretches from TV's The West Wing and Nurse Jackie to her recently being awarded National Humanities Medal by President Obama. She's also a university professor at Stanford. Well, actually, New York University.
No, New York University.
Yeah, forget. Stanford's loss, NYU's gain, at least for the present. Again, feel free to join us. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Talking about, well, dramatic transformation, about her work, about artistry, and about the social impact of the sort of art, whatever it may be, that you may do or that Anna Deavere Smith has done so extraordinarily. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Anna Deavere Smith, well-known certainly for not only her work on TV like The West Wing and Nurse Jackie, but also the extraordinary one-woman performances that she brought to life, Fires in the Mirror, Twilight Los Angeles, Let Me Down Easy, and she's now in the process of writing a play about education, which we are all waiting for with bated breath. Get to our callers here, but ask you something. I was reading an interview you did where you said you were rummaging around. I don't know when this was, but you were rummaging around in City Lights bookstore looking for plays about black characters or plays by playwrights of color. And I don't know when this was, but, you know, I was, and you were saying that your gods were the usual gods, Albee and Miller and Williams and Shakespeare and Moliere. And I thought to myself, well, you know, August Wilson's been around for quite a while. There, you know, Antasaki Shange, Luis Valdez. I mean, Frank Chin. There have been a lot of...
That was all before them.
That was all before them.
This was in 1972 and 1973. And I had just been introduced to the theater. I hadn't had any intention of being an actor. It was a sort of a fluke that I tripped over here in San Francisco, where I came looking for social change and the opportunity to do something about that, and was in an acting class in the Summer Institute, the training congress at ACT, where I thought, wow, people are changing. Why don't I hang around here? So I think it also had to do with where I was in school, because across the way, the Grassroots Theater Company, which I don't think they still exist anymore, they were sort of the outpost for Ed Bull. So that is true. But where I was training, there wasn't a lot going on.
Ed Bullins was a student of mine, actually.
Really?
Really.
Wow.
Yeah. And but there was all that Lafayette Theater and all that Black Harlem
Theater. All of that, but not at ACT at the time. So I was looking around for scenes to try to have something else that I could bring to the table when asked to. We could pick scenes, I think, every 3 weeks or something like that. And, you know, the menu was not Ed Bullins or the Lafayette Theater at ACT.
But, you know, O'Neill had written a lot of plays that were Emperor Jones and All Got Show and Got Wings, and he went through a whole period, and the Haywards,
of course.
But
then you throw yeah. women into it, right? So, but, you know, at that time, the way I was being trained, as fabulous as it was, we didn't even know about Sam Shepard, who was also here in town at the time.
Mostly at the Magic Theater. Yeah.
Mostly at the Magic Theater, but wasn't part of what we were doing. And even my early years of teaching, I'd give kids Sam Shepard, and they'd be like, do I have to do that? You know, can I do Arthur Miller? So even students themselves, you know, were very, very tied to certain accepted icons.
Speaking about accepted icons, in 1996, you interviewed a series of presidents, including Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush, and you turned those interviews into performances. I'd like, before we go to our calls and our emails, listeners, to hear a clip of your imitation of Bill Clinton, where he's criticizing the Republicans for investigating him and his wife.
I don't even know where you all pick this up, because I only performed this once or twice in public.
Well, we have Irene. look through the glass. Irene Noguchi gets her props.
Get that at the, you know, the bargain basement at Sears.
You're not going to censor this, are you? I want people to hear this. Let's hear
this.
Go ahead.
I was so naive that I really believe them when they said, if you were honest and forthright, it would clear the air. I mean, it's chilling when you really think about what happened. When Hillary's legal bills were found, oh, it was all over the papers, right? She had to go talk to the grand jury. First lady going to the grand jury. Big pictures. Now, what happened? We said, we don't know where these came from. We're glad they turned up because they support her story. Why would we cover up records that support her story? That was down in paragraph 10 here. Then what happened? Another totally independent inquiry by a Republican law firm spent $3.6 million looking at all the documents on the savings loan. You know what it said? No basis for criminal action. No basis for a civil suit. The records support Hillary's account. Did all those people who blared the record discovery, who blared the grand jury testimony, all of America bother to tell the American people that that's what this report done by a Republican law firm after they spent almost $4 million said? No. Little bitty notice made. So, what I'm saying is, you know, we're fine. We're standing here. We're showing up for work. We're fine. Bad for America. Bad for the system. Makes good people less willing to run. And it corrupts the search for the truth.
All right. And Irene has given away the secret she found in an interview you did with Studio 360, just so you know for the record. But that's an extraordinary rendering of Clinton, who you liked, I think, didn't you?
Oh, yes, I did. And the thing that I got to say about that is that years ago, a linguist gave me three questions I could ask that would guarantee that people would speak in an idiosyncratic way, which was hard in Washington. The thing about Washington is a scholar of Jefferson told me that Jefferson couldn't be found in verbal undress. So I think that that sort of set the scene for a kind of haute couture of language where people don't do, they keep it real, as conservative as their clothes, their language. And what I liked about talking to the president was when I asked him a version of one of those questions I'd been given, one of the questions that will guarantee that people speak in an interesting way is, have you ever been accused of something that you did not do? And I knew that when I talked to Clinton, I was only going to have 10 minutes. So I had to find a question where he would do all the talking and I wouldn't take up any time with my question. So the question I asked him was, Mr. President, do you feel you're being treated like a common criminal? And he just went into this extraordinary, I think, kind of jazz state where he goes from a word like, I'm almost afraid to do it, but Blair! That on the one hand, to little tiny, little bitty notice mate. So from this big, big sound to this little tiny, little bitty notice mate. So that even though he's sitting in the White House, and this was done in the Oval Office, this man had no problem breaking all of the conventions of speech. He wasn't worried about that. And he made all these wonderful, great, big sounds. I had a ball. I think he was extraordinary.
You also got his, I use a word I probably shouldn't use on the air, his garrulity, you know, I mean, his loquaciousness, his the fact is that he doesn't even come up for breath when he talks, really, does he?
Probably more breath than I gave him right then. But it's a lot of words and a lot of imagination and a lot of power, a lot of vocal power. You know,
you think about it, you know, Toni Morrison said, you know, first black president,
right,
uses rhetoric,
right,
like,
right. As a matter of fact, I alluded to the fact that I'd written about Obama after the 2004 campaign. And one of the things that I was riffing about in the New York Times op-ed that I wrote about it was that Clinton was really the black speaker at that convention. And Obama was, I called Lonnie Guinier to say, who is this guy? Tell me about this cat. And, you know, what she pointed out was, she said, he's not actually speaking in black oratory. He's speaking out of a literary tradition and more like a legal brief.
Yeah, but so, you can hear sounds from Obama depending on who his audience are.
Exactly.
I mean, even Hillary, you know, started sounding like she was doing black dialect.
Well, I guess they need to talk to black people, don't they?
They do. Let's talk to our listeners here. And Peter, we begin with you. Hi, Peter.
Hi. What a lively, lively interview here. Thank you for this. I was just wondering if you could comment, please, Ms. Smith, on the role of celebrity actors in social responsibility. I know you've been so active in this area. I thought it would be interesting to hear your comments in general.
Well, I mean, I think that any celebrity who wants to come forward and say something in a time of need in a culture is embraced and can do powerful things, whether it's to speak, whether it's to assign themselves to a particular issue somewhere in the world. Or I believe Dolly Parton just made I think she spent more money on books than anybody. I don't know the number, but like much money to give kids the opportunity to read books. So whether it's out of philanthropy or whether it's out of assigning themselves to a particular issue to bring attention to it, I think we as a public are very heartened by that, and we all welcome them.
And I thank Peter for the call. We'll go to more of your calls in just a moment. What was your response to what was supposed to be the ultimate interview with Lance Armstrong by Oprah, but what turned out to be maybe an interview that raised even a lot more questions because you spent a lot of time with him and did a lot of rendering of him, that is,
right,
Lance Armstrong.
Yeah. Well, you know, I spent a lot of time studying Lance Armstrong and performing him for my play Let Me Down Easy. I was saddened by what happened because I do become very attached to the characters that I portray, no matter who they are or what side of the fence. About
even if they're trying to take you in?
I don't know that he was trying to take me in. I think that in that interview, he was trying to, if anything, no, I wouldn't say that's what he does. That's not his style. With Lance Armstrong, you get more of the feeling that any minute he's going to say, you know, I'm tired of this interview. I got to quit. You know, I can't sit here any longer. You get that feeling. So, so I was grateful for the time I had with him, and I had quite a bit of joy in studying him. So in that way, I do become protective of the people that I portray. I guess a journalist would never say that. And so I really didn't, you know, it was hard for me to see him go through what he went through.
We'll bring on more of our callers, and we go to Sheila next. Sheila, join us. You're on.
Hi. I just wanted to say I've been a fan of your work, Ms. Smith, for a long, long time. And actually, I'm rewatching all of The West Wing right now, while I'm also watching the latest season of Nurse Jackie, and it's a fun contrast to watch you do those two characters. But what I really called to say is that back in the early 90s, I was originally I got an undergraduate and a graduate degree in theater, and I was really, you know, impassioned about, you know, feminist theater and queer theater and performance art and autobiographical work like Spalding Gray and social justice oriented work like yours. And you were a particular favorite of mine. I found your work tremendously inspiring with how it pushed the boundaries of what theater is supposed to be for. And I ultimately decided that a career in theater was not the right direction for me, but where I went afterwards was into mental health, and I became a marriage and family therapist. And I'm now a worker out in the community, and I teach graduate school, and yet the passion for getting real about issues like race and class and gender and creating change in the world is still very, very much a part of my work. And I would trace that line directly back to the ways that your work, among others, inspired me. And so I just wanted to say thank you for that and how much of an admirer I've always been.
Well, thank you and good luck. Good luck.
Thank you.
It must be gratifying to hear that kind of influence. How much did Spalding Gray or Lily Tomlin influence you?
Oh, yeah. That's a really great question. Spalding Gray had a huge effect because of a workshop that I took in Pittsburgh when I was teaching at Carnegie Mellon. It was just a breath of fresh air, and B, it really turned me on to the possibility of what it means to make your own work in another way. And also, I had never thought about this whole idea of performing yourself, which is what Gray did. I wasn't that interested in that. I've always been rather interested in performing others, even in my distance from the Stanislavski technique, which is the notion of an inner self, which has universality. But I just was so intrigued by how he knew the specifics of his own behavior. And I think that affected me a great deal because I already was very apt towards looking at specific gestures and linguistic moments in any given sentence that a person spoke. And then the other thing was I was very upset and drawn to his piece Rumstick Road, and I believe that's the piece where he talks on the phone to his mother's psychiatrist, and you feel as though it's happening in real time, but it's not. And so the personalness of that, you know, back in 1978 when I was introduced to that, just the whole idea of having your mother's psychiatrist on the phone and talking, it blew my mind. I have to say Spalding Gray blew my mind. Now, Lily Tomlin, we're all sitting at the feet of Lily Tomlin, any of us who are doing any type of single work, singular work, her imagination, her discipline. She and Jane both, and I've got a chance to know them. They called me up as soon as my career took off on two lines of the phone, gave me incredible advice. They're very generous. I think the way they are generous with people who are just coming into the sort of known part of their career, I hope I've been able to supply that in my own mentorship. I wrote a book called Letters to a Young Artist.
Can you talk about what they advise you?
Well, no, I don't want to because I feel it's a breaking of their confidentiality. They gave me really good career advice, very honest and open. But also with them, it's just this unending discipline. With Lily Tomlin, it's just to this day, wherever she's working, I know that it doesn't come like it doesn't just pop out of your mouth, you know. It's this constant pursuit of excellence. And that was interesting for me to see that, wow, she's Lily Tomlin. And, wow, it's that detailed? It's that much preparation? Yeah.
Also, from that era, I remember the kind of comedic work that people like Richard Pryor and Robert Klein were doing, because they were doing different voices.
Right, you know. Right. Well, these were geniuses, you know. And Lily, as you know, she did some stuff with Richard Pryor. She played a black man. Purvis, I think, was his name. And that's probably not a character that immediately comes to mind. So, you know, these are just geniuses. And luckily, it's recorded. I remember.
But they don't have a MacArthur Genius Grant, and Anna DeVere
Smith
does.
Maybe they weren't giving them out then. I don't know. Or maybe they were too famous. You know, they don't tend to give them to real famous, you know, people.
Here's a listener who says, I was fortunate to be in Anna's workshop, Acting and Empathy, in San Francisco in June. A life-changing opportunity. Anna is an inspiring person of incredible generosity. Thank you, Anna. Another listener says, I'm curious to hear Ms. DeVere Smith's take on the current political show Sweeping TV, a.k.a. Scandal and House of Cards. Does she think their over-the-top snark and negative portrayal of Washington discourages people from engaging in the political process?
You know, I have not. I'm so embarrassed to admit that I haven't seen them. I'm excited to hear that House of Cards is such a success because it was created in a different way, everyone. So part of it has to do with the vehicle. And then I'm a great fan of Kerry Washington, and I'm just thrilled to see her on the cover.
She just got married, in fact.
Did she? Yeah. I don't know, but she's on the cover of everything, and I know.
To a 49ers ball player, in fact.
All right, I think I met him, right? So with her, no, I mean, I've known her. We were in a movie together called The Human Stain when she was just starting out, and so.
It's based on the Philip Roth novel.
On the Philip Roth novel, and so to playing the girlfriend of a guy who's passing for white. You know, to know also how hard she works, how hard she has worked to make a career that's very difficult to have.
Did you see Django Unchained?
I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. And I loved her. I thought that her work was amazing. Oh, I loved that movie so much. The Capriciousness of Power, a friend of mine, put it the best, I think. My manager, Judy Farkas, said that. That's what that movie is about, the capriciousness of power.
Let me bring some more callers on here. And by the way, this is a we're going to get a caller on named Lisa up in Petaluma. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you? I'm just curious. I just turned 50. I'm African-American, and I'm actually ready to start studying theater and acting. And I'm curious, if she was starting out at my age now, if she would choose San Francisco or a smaller market like Sacramento. And I ask that because I told it's better to start at a smaller than a larger. And Sacramento turns out to be very diverse. So I just kind of wanted to, oh, and also I wanted to ask her about classes versus just getting on stage and going for it. That was my question.
Well, I don't know how old you are, if you'll say.
I think you said you're 50, didn't you?
I am 50, yeah.
She revealed.
Oh, she revealed. Okay, I missed that, 50. Yeah, well, I think the world is your oyster. It doesn't really matter. You could go to London. You could go to Johannesburg. You could go to Sacramento. You could start in your own town. I bet you Petaluma, that's where you are, right?
Yes, it is.
I think there's some theaters there. I don't think it really matters. I think it just matters that you start, and then something will come. I really do mean that. I know that sounds really, really trite. But the main thing is, don't end today without making a step towards that dream.
Okay.
Good luck to you, Gloria, Elisa.
Good
and
luck.
Thank you for the call. Actually, I almost said Gloria because I thought maybe it would be appropriate to bring in a clip here. Showtime series Nurse Jackie with Edie Falco and Anna DeVere Smith is still on Showtime on demand. You play, that is, Anna plays.
We're going back for another season.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Congratulations. She plays a hospital administrator, Gloria Alkalaitis.
Alkalaitis.
And she is a bitingly sarcastic character. I wanted to have listeners hear a few clips from a fan video just to get a sense of the character.
A-K-A-L-I-T as in Tom, U-S as in Sam. But that doesn't mean I want to leave a message, because I don't. Are you asking for time off? Today? Right now? This day? Reconsider. I'm coming to get you. Heads will roll. Your head's not made of glass, Miss Barco. No one can see what you're thinking. Handcuffs. You're 43. He's 43.
I'm going to have a seizure and die. You're going to get shut down. I won't care. I'm going to be rich.
You'll be dead. Have a nice day.
Well, you love playing that role, don't you?
I have a ball. That was Danny Hawk on the other side having the seizure. And then Miss Barco, of course, is quite extraordinary. I can barely get through my scenes with her without losing it laughing.
Another listener, I'm looking at some tweets here. Jan says, I love your work. Wonder if you might create a piece on Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. You'd said before that it certainly interested you. Drew, you're not working on anything?
No, not, but I'm sure somebody out there is right now, and I encourage them to do so.
Now, Jim tweets, how does social media offer new and different opportunities to reach and engage audiences in efforts to advance social change, and how do you use it?
Well, you know, I hope that social media is not just talk. We write things and we think we've done stuff. And that's the only caution I would have about it, is that the high engagement, which is great. I'm now tweeting, and I've managed to boost up my followers to a little bit over 9,000. Nothing like some of my friends on Nurse Jackie, who have millions. But we shouldn't think that just because we're shouting out across the digit sphere that we're doing stuff. Doing stuff means going down to the school and seeing if you can help out, going to the food pantry or voting or registering people to vote. So we still haven't gotten away from the need to actually do something. You know, earlier you alluded to Entezaki Shange, who didn't come about until after my years sitting in the basement of my favorite bookstore in the world, City Lights Bookstore. And I'll never forget, in her groundbreaking, earth-scorching work, of course, for Colored Girls, which did get developed in part here, but I didn't even know she was here. You know, there's this one little sort of twist that she does on the notion of the absurdity of thinking that we don't have to do anything. We can just think and it's going to happen. That's the problem of limiting our lives to these small devices that we live with right now. We got to get up and be the full 5'8" and whatever pounds. And moving in the world to do something.
Leave the virtual world. Jeff writes, first, I love Ms. Smith's work. Want to thank her for the intelligence and passion she brings to it. My question is about the character she plays in Nurse Jackie. It seems to me that initially Gloria was feared and mocked by the ER staff. Now she seems to be a beloved team member. Does she believe that describes her character's trajectory, and how did she manage that transition?
I don't manage the transition.
It's the script
writers. In
this
case,
yeah.
It's the script writers. And so it's whatever they put on that page that I read on Friday afternoon on the read-through is what I do. Those are the rules.
Let me bring another caller on, and that's you, Scott. Welcome. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Love your work on Nurse Jackie, definitely the most fun character on the show. But I wanted to get your opinion on the race versus poverty. I call it the false battle, because I grew up in a pretty low-income, mixed racial community in L.A., and we couldn't afford to be racist. And, you know, on any Saturday afternoon, the Espositos would be over with our family and the two black families, I mean, instead of us having a barbecue. That's how it was. There wasn't the luxury of racism. We were all poor. And I see.
I wouldn't think of racism as luxurious, by the way.
Yeah, well,
sorry.
It is.
Just
it
my
is
own semantic recoiling there, yeah.
It is when you're able to pit poor against race and call that some sort of division, which is what I think is being artificially played up in our society, even though there are racial groups who have, by far and away, more poverty in their groups than a lot of other people. But
Scott, I think you're talking about growing up in a place where racism was not all that evident. Are you saying that maybe more emphasis should be put on class?
Absolutely. I think the battle that gets pitted between poor people and people's race just diverts attention away from the unifying struggle of poverty that poor people all face, regardless of color. That's the battle that needs to be fought in this country, I think.
Yeah, well, thank you for the observation. Anna DeVere Smith.
Well, yeah, and we often, you know, throughout time have talked about the need to look at social class, which is as much of a taboo, not as much of a taboo as race, but it is a taboo. I mean, so thinking about education, I'm thinking about Sean Reardon, who is a professor at Stanford, wrote a really wonderful op-ed on the front page, was put on the front page of the review in the Sunday of New York Times, called No Rich Child Left Behind. And the graphic was this huge, you know, limousine, stretch limousine. And part of what Sean is offering is that where one of the ways we need to be concerned right now is that we've always known that the gap between rich and poor is quite wide. But what's really happening, that we can see happening in education and where people can go to college and how they're educated, is that the wealthy are really pulling away with quite some speed from the middle class. And so this gap between the middle class and wealthy people is also something to really be concerned about in terms of who is able to make it in the current educational system and who is not. Then, of course, my interest is the people who are literally, really being shoved out. We don't have very much aptitude. We don't use our resources, intellectual or otherwise, to think about how do we help the people who've been left behind. I see the last 20 years, particularly because of where I get to teach, it's so much has been about finding the gifted people. Remember when that started? I mean, I don't know if you had that in school. I didn't really. No, but so what about using our resources to recover the people who are being left behind? And what about changing our society from one that tends to punish people relentlessly who are being left behind to embrace them and take care of them? I think that that is the case and that it is a class issue and a race issue. It is not either or.
And I thank the caller. And you're teaching at NYU now rather than Stanford, but you're on the board of Grace Cathedral, so you're bi-coastal?
I come back and forth. And I did a lot. You know, look, I developed Let Me Down Easy in large part through the help of Stanford Medical School. So I still have a big spot for Stanford University in my heart. And I'm fortunate to have a gig at New York University.
And we're fortunate to have you here and await, as I said, with excitement this creation that you're, I mean, I'm sure it's exciting and challenging and maybe even a little bit scary to go into this new territory. Yeah.
True.
Good luck with it.
It's true.
Good to see you. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. Really.
Anna DeVere Smith, and we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening, and remind you that you can always continue to keep conversations going on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. I also want to remind you who is behind the scenes here and play very important roles. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg, with our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. And our engineer is Danny Bringer. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, thank you for being a part of this morning's program. Back tomorrow. In fact, we're going to be in the second hour tomorrow with Fareed Zakaria, who will Reza Aslan, who will be joining us. Not Fareed Zakaria, Reza Aslan, be talking about his new book on Jesus. Join us for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and the Sue Ann Gershenson Trust.